You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we talked to WPR reporters for a firsthand look at the Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders rallies in Wisconsin yesterday.
First, a U.S. Supreme Court decision this week had a major impact on a labor law challenge with national implications. Or maybe it was a Supreme Court non-decision with the 8-member court evenly divided.
The 4-4 tie demonstrates how the unfilled vacancy on the High Court may affect laws in the future, including a challenge to the Affordable Care Act's mandate on contraceptive coverage.
Joining us for a closer look is political science professor Kimmy King at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, good to have you back.
Hey, good to be back.
Well, before we get to the broader implications, let's take a look at this. One of the first big cases to come to the Supreme Court now that it's an 8-member Supreme Court. Talk us through this labor law challenge.
Well, this in essence dealt with the ability of public sector employees to opt out of the union. And you know, in a number of states, not Wisconsin's, yours is separate from that, but I believe it's in 21 states, there's a requirement that unions can also charge non-union members for what they call chargeable fees. And it's in essence a way of recognizing that unions may bargain collectively and get benefits for non-union members, and they want to be able to get their share of that money and the benefit. And so, in essence, the court's divided opinion is considered a victory for organized labor, which looked like it was set to lose because they didn't have that 9 justice. Anytime you have a Supreme Court decision in which there's a tie vote, the tie goes to whoever won at the last level. And so because organized labor had won at the last level, it's going to leave a victory for them in place. The larger question is, where do we go from here? Because we have a number of cases, class actions, capital sentencing, juvenile justice, abortion, affirmative action, contraception, immigration, jury selection, voting rights, that are all in the balance. And these are the most pivotal issues of our day. This is exactly the kind of thing that all the candidates are out there debating about. So do we just sit tight for a year while we have a divided court?
And I want to tackle one of those issues you just mentioned, where we saw kind of a weird thing out of the court, contraceptive coverage, a challenge to the contraceptive coverage mandate under the Affordable Care Act. There's a religious liberty-based challenge to it. Now, you mentioned that in the case of a tie, the lower court, whatever their last decision won, just rides. It stays in effect. This is one where different courts have had different decisions. So a tie vote, if it came out that way, means the law works differently in one part of the country and differently in another part of the country.
That's correct. And we've talked several times in the past about the past patchwork quilt that is constitutional law. And that's one of the issues that are so interesting about this particular case. It's the Zubik versus Burwell case, in which there's an evaluation of whether contraception coverage and that requirement, which is under the Affordable Care Act, requires religiously affiliated institutions like schools, Catholic hospitals, that feel very strongly that they do not want to provide either certain types of contraception or contraception in general for religious reasons. Must they be mandated to do so? So the Obama administration had tried to work out avoiding the requirement under the Affordable Care Act by saying they could fill out a form, but a number of institutions felt like that still violated their religious principles. So without that 9th justice, it seems fairly clear, given where the justices are coming ideologically, that it's going to sustain some of the accommodation to those religious groups and organizations, but not all. So that means the law is going to be one thing in one circuit and another in another circuit, and that's problematic.
And so the Supreme Court did something a little weird here. They asked for, or as I understand it, this is unusual, they said, hey, both sides, we want a rebriefing. We want you to get more info, and hey, take a look at this idea just hypothetically. That's unusual, right?
It is unusual for them to do a rebriefing, but it is not so surprising given Chief Justice John Roberts' leadership. Remember, he is the critical member in the case which upheld the Affordable Care Act and its constitutionality, which said that Congress did have the authority under its taxing and spending clause powers to establish the Affordable Care Act. He sided with the liberals on that, but then he sided with the conservatives on the Commerce Clause issues. So he really indicated in that opinion that he was standing right on the edge of the bridge and saying, I am not going to be the one that makes this call. In fact, in his opinion, he points out that there's an upcoming election and that there will be a possibility to speak on that. And then in the 2012 election, Obama won. So it's possible that Roberts is trying to say, we are not going to sit here and twiddle our thumbs for the remaining 300-plus days while Congress gets its political act together.
Talking to Kimmy King from the University of North Texas about our U.S. Supreme Court, our 8-member U.S. Supreme Court, a 4-4 tie on a key issue, prospect for lots more of them to come. So, Kimmy, is this going to leave a lot of things in effect in limbo if people can't persuade a 5-3 majority on a lot of these issues?
Well, it will, you know, the question is, we have, for example, the affirmative action decision, which was argued in December, and that deals with a race-conscious program. That's not even a 4-4 decision. That's a 7-member court because Kagan had to recuse herself, having been part of the Obama Justice Department before her appointment. This has been a case that's been working its way through the court for years, through the court system. And so it's not even 4-4 there, right? But all of those issues that I read to you before, I mean, most interestingly, the issue of abortion, which, as we saw yesterday, is back on the national agenda with everyone talking about it. The case of Whole Woman's Health versus Cole that will take Texas abortion clinics down from more than 40 to almost 10 because of restrictions that were put on it by the Texas legislature. That's the one that everybody's watching closely, and in addition to the contraception case, but that one in particular. And what will happen there is that the clinics will close. So that's going to be an interesting forcing of that decision.
Now, in addition to this 4-4 issue, another big change is that Antonin Scalia is no longer there. I saw a quote from law professor Erwin Chemerinsky in USA Today saying none of them, the other justices, has ever been on the court without Justice Scalia. And I guess it's emerging that he is the guy who led the way on questioning. He's the guy who crystallized opinions for the people who agreed with him and the people who disagreed. Like, what he said let them know, in effect, what they were arguing about. They're kind of at loose ends in some ways, aren't they?
You know, that's actually a really fascinating point about the role of Scalia as kind of the godfather, right, of the Supreme Court, because love him or hate him, virtually everybody had the highest level of respect for his opinions and his judicial integrity. And while he could alienate people, you know, he was notorious for alienating Kennedy and O'Connor, it will be curious to see the role that more senior members take on, like Kennedy. And I would suggest to you that where you're going to want to look is the role that Kennedy plays in a number of these decisions. Kennedy was a critical person back in a case in the 1990s that undercut abortion, or basically allowed the states to regulate more heavily abortion. And Kennedy departed from his kind of Catholic orthodoxy to be able to narrowly craft an opinion. So there's some thinking here that Kennedy is doing some of that behind-the-scenes work, that he is starting to pick up the mantle of where Scalia might have left off.
And this, of course, is all happening against this backdrop of the effort to put a new 9th member of the court, Merrick Garland, the president's nominee. Some limited thawing in the Senate as far as at least some Republican senators being willing not to have a hearing, not to vote on him, but to talk to the guy in person. What are we seeing there?
Well, you know, you actually, it's interesting enough, you are starting to see some movement in that regard, which I think most people a couple of weeks ago would have been surprised about. Part of the reason why that started happening was because there was a public opinion poll out where 2/3 of Americans indicated that they wanted the court to at least look at a nominee. And I think that that's part of what's contributing to it. So you've seen Susan Collins of Maine, John Boozman of Arkansas, both say that they are going to plan on meetings. But then you have other GOP offices who are reaching out, you know, Lankford from Oklahoma, Inhofe from Oklahoma have also said they will reach out. You've got aides from Republicans in New Hampshire and West Virginia. And I think that part of what is starting to roll is that the increased level of tension within the Republican Party over the Trump-Cruz spat that is going on is forcing Republicans to look deep in their districts and try to in their states and try to evaluate what is going to happen to me and where do I need to throw my political fate, and is this the issue that I'm really willing to take a stand on? And I think that's why you're starting to see Republican movement.
We're talking right now with political science professor Kimmy King about this week's Supreme Court deadlock, how the ongoing vacancy is affecting court cases on high-profile issues.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think that the vacancy on the court should be filled as soon as possible, or does this latest decision demonstrate to you that we should wait until the next president is elected? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our conversation about how the current vacancy on the Supreme Court is affecting court cases and labor laws, contraceptive coverage, and more.
University of North Texas political science professor Kimmy King stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Senate should meet with the candidate for the court, vote on the candidate, approve the candidate, or should it wait for the next election or for the next president to be in place? Does the makeup of the court concern you? Is it something that you vote on in the election? Do you think it's leaned too far left or right? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Kimmy, we heard from a Buzz on Facebook who says the fact that the Senate is not considering the nominee is dereliction of their duty. And Buzz says, so is the behavior of Democratic senators from Wisconsin that ran to Illinois rather than do their duty. So that's a little while back in Wisconsin history. But he's making himself out to be somebody who will judge based on performance, not on ideology. Is there among voters, do you think, Kimmy, a lot of people who think, I'm not worried about this as a Republican or a Democrat. I have a view on how the job should be done?
I think that's right. And remember, we're going to continue paying everybody their salaries regardless of whether anything gets done. Meanwhile, we are literally looking at millions of dollars in litigation that will be, in essence, put on hold or perhaps lost. You will continue to see other cases come forward. It really does create difficulty. I think one of the things to go back to Kennedy before that's interesting is that this idea of having somebody be nominated and confirmed in an election year has long been a political volleyball. I mean, you know, Obama, Biden, they have all done this in the past, raising the specter of concerns about the appointment in election years. The fact of the matter is, Justice Kennedy himself was nominated in 1987, but then was confirmed in 1988, an election year. We have a number of instances going back in history where opposition-controlled Congresses have managed to get their act together and reach a consensus candidate. And I really think that that's kind of the interesting thing about what President Obama did by nominating Garland, is that he's such a centrist. In some ways, one of the reasons why you see support for people like the person who sent you the message is that, you know, Garland is really kind of an ideal candidate for Republicans in an otherwise catchy time. Do you wait and be concerned about a Hillary Clinton nominee or a Trump nominee? Or do you take this guy now and hope that he's someone that can be turned, right? Because that happens.
Let's go to our callers now, starting with Dennis on the line in Ripon. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I always hear the Republican senators saying that they want the American people to have a say in the nominee or how it goes. But the American people already had a say when they elected those senators, and they should stand up and do their job.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And that's what a lot of people are saying and arguing that President Obama was elected and still president. Is that going to carry water, though, Kimmy?
It's interesting. I do think it's a function of the leadership, and the point that your caller is making is actually also part of the reason why the Republican Party is struggling just a little bit. It's this idea that there is a select group of establishment members who are leadership, who are calling the shots on policy. That's why a Ted Cruz rose up. He rose up to challenge the establishment. And so that's part of what this negative energy with people being unhappy about the Senate not going ahead and moving this forward. That's where this is coming from.
Do you think as the Donald Trump campaign goes on, if it becomes clear that he is the Republican nominee, that's maybe the time that Republicans say, okay, that's a wild card. Let's take, as you mentioned, this more centrist candidate and versus the liberal that a Democrat would do or the who knows what Trump might do.
Yeah, it's kind of a deal or no deal, right?
Yeah.
You're getting to a point with a deal of no deal. You know, all bets are off with Trump. I think that one of the reasons, you know, in terms of making a call on where that's going to go, one of the things that I think is really interesting and why you're seeing some shift inside the Republicans being willing to at least have their aides negotiate a possibility of a meeting with Garland is there's a third tack here that you could take, and that is, as a centrist Republican, you look like you're not giving in to the establishment Republican Party. You agree and push forward to the hearings. You grill him nonstop. And at the end of the day, remember, they're going to have 14 additional votes in order to get him confirmed. And that creates a real possibility that you could have some behind-the-scenes political shenanigans, that you could drag this out, see if it's going to be Cruz or Trump, and then play your hand accordingly. And that may be what you're starting to see with some of your more moderate Republicans.
We'll bring on another caller now. Katie is with us in Clinton. Katie, hi.
Hi. I usually, when I do my voting, I will look at both candidates. I don't normally go Republican or Democratic. I look at the candidates. And if I've got two candidates that are fairly even, I will go towards the one that will vote for a Supreme Court justice. In case in point, I'm looking at Feingold and Johnson. Johnson has already come out and said he will not support any hearings or anything. I will go Feingold.
Katie, thanks a lot for the call. Kimmy, just a few moments. Do you think there are a lot of voters in tight Senate races like ours in Wisconsin who are thinking that way?
What your caller said is absolutely excellent, and I think that it is a very good point that senators are trying to weigh the calculus on. Yes, I think it will be a determining point. It's also because I think your caller is tapping into that frustration that it's time for the do-nothing Senate, the do-nothing House to start doing something rather than saying they're just going to continue waiting.
We'll leave it there for now. As always, Kimmy, good to talk to you.
Great to see you. Take it easy.
That's the University of North Texas political science professor Kimmy King. She joins today to look at some recent deadlocked votes at the U.S. Supreme Court, what the 4-4 tie means, and, of course, the politics of the current nomination on the table for that court.
The candidates for state Supreme Court say they would both carry out their duties without bias if elected next Tuesday. At the same time, they're sending partisan hints to their likely supporters in this officially nonpartisan race. In our first of two profiles, Sean Johnson has this report on appeals court judge Joanne Kloppenburg.
Joanne Kloppenburg could say nothing at all on this campaign, and there would still be some Democratic voters who know she's their candidate in Tuesday's election. This is Kloppenburg's second try for the Supreme Court. She ran her first campaign in 2011 when the election got hyper-politicized, swept up in the fight over Governor Scott Walker's collective bargaining law. It put so much focus on the Supreme Court race that Jesse Jackson came to Wisconsin for get-out-the-vote rallies the day before the election.
When we vote tomorrow, you make Dr. King happy.
Kloppenburg's explicit message in 2011 was the same as it is now. She's running for the court because she's impartial. But at nearly every campaign stop this year, she also takes a shot at Governor Walker and at her opponent, Justice Rebecca Bradley.
I was elected to the Court of Appeals. I owe my judicial career to the people of Wisconsin. Rebecca Bradley owes her judicial career to Governor Walker.
Governor Walker appointed Bradley to the Circuit Court, the Appeals Court, and the State Supreme Court. Every time Kloppenburg brings up the connection, former Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Gieske says she's sending a message.
Clearly, I think she's signaling that, you know, unless you want somebody on the bench who's simply going to do what the Republicans want her to do, you know, you want me.
There's nothing explicitly partisan about Kloppenburg's biography, but there's a lot that liberals might like in the stuff that she highlights. Kloppenburg served in the Peace Corps, and she prosecuted environmental cases with the State Department of Justice. When asked to name a decision she authored that demonstrates her judicial philosophy, Kloppenburg mentioned State v. Crute.
And this involved issuing citations to groups that were gathering in the Capitol over a three-month period in 2013.
Kloppenburg ruled in favor of anti-Walker protesters in that case, which was a blow to the governor's administration. Kloppenburg has donated money to Democrats, and she's supported by Democratic-leaning groups like unions and the Wisconsin Association for Justice, which represents trial lawyers. Association past President Christine Bremer Moogley says Kloppenburg has the intellectual backbone for the job.
She will have an open mind and will be thorough and will be prepared and will not be partisan in her decision-making.
On the U.S. Supreme Court, Kloppenburg says she admires Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor, who were both appointed by Democratic presidents. During a recent debate, Bradley said that sent a negative signal that Kloppenburg would let her personal feelings influence her decisions.
My opponent has a judicial philosophy that is starkly different from mine that will allow her to introduce her personal policy preferences and the type of outcome that she wants to achieve into her judicial decision making.
While Kloppenburg disputed that, she focused her response, as she has all year, on bringing it back to Bradley's background.
My opponent was appointed by Governor Scott Walker three times to three judgeships in 3 years.
In debates and elsewhere, Kloppenburg has said very little about how she would have decided some of the big cases that have come before the Supreme Court, from Act 10 to voter ID. But in between the subtle and not-so-subtle hints this campaign, voters may have an easy time connecting the dots. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tune in tomorrow for part two of our series on the Wisconsin State Supreme Court race when we take a closer look at Justice Rebecca Bradley.
Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk to two WPR reporters who covered the Ted Cruz and Bernie Sanders campaign events yesterday. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.